Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
This week, Operation Elvedon. With yet more journalists cleared of paying officials for stories, what lessons can be learned? And should the DPP resign? Striking the balance between editorial and advertising. Newspapers have been criticised for allegedly allowing advertisers to influence their coverage. But is it so wrong that they have a say? And newspaper owners and their political influence. Rupert Murdoch has told his papers that they are not doing enough to stop Labour winning on May the 7th. And Richard Desmond has given £1.3 million to UKIP. Should we be worried? And nowadays, do newspapers even have any influence come election time? And as usual, we're joined by two of the media's best and brightest. Lara O'Reilly is Global Advertising Editor at Business Insider, and Adam Sherwin is Media Correspondent at The Independent.
Media Focus.
So first up, 4 years since the start of Operation Elvedon, only one conviction stands. A further four journalists have just been cleared, and the CPS has dropped charges against nine others. The investigation has been criticised for wasting £20 million of public money and making a standard Fleet Street practice a criminal offence. A number of journalists have called for the resignation of both the DPP and the Chief of the Metropolitan Police. Adam, what do you make of this, and what effect has Elvedon actually had on Fleet Street?
Well, there's been a real sort of sense of vindication just this last few days with this, so many cases having been dropped. And it really does seem as if the zeal that the police and the prosecution services went about, the way they arrested these journalists with Dawn arrests, completely out of proportion with the kind of offences that they were going to be charged with. And now the jurors have taken a very different view. They've said that, look, we understand that sometimes journalists have to do things like pay public officials in order to get stories that are in the public interest. And we've been through the ones in the court cases, and there's been stories about kind of troops abroad not being given the correct equipment by the MOD, about notorious criminals being given special privileges in prison. And the juries have just looked at all these cases and said, you know, tabloids might do a grubby business, but it's necessary and somebody's got to do it.
It was against the law, though, wasn't it, in many cases? I mean, even if it's a technical breach, do you think that the DPP was doing her best to uphold the law? What do you think her motivation was? Where do you think the pressures on her were?
There was this a lot of kind of hysteria, maybe, after the initial phone hacking accusations were made. And there was the Leveson inquiry, and Leveson was told that there was a kind of network of corrupt payments that had been going on for many years. And so rightly, they wanted to investigate this. And then they got a huge cache of emails from News International, which was kind of cleaning up its stables after the phone hacking allegations were made. And so there was an awful lot of information coming through to the police. And a lot of it did suggest that, yes, payments had been made to officials. Now, they wanted to investigate those, but they probably should have thought, what really is the public interest here? Are we going to get prosecutions? Is the standard of evidence of corruption here higher than it would be in maybe in some other cases? Because we have to put the freedom of the press and the ability to inform the public about issues higher than maybe a technical offence of someone being paid a little bit of money for that information.
It seems that the public outrage reached a crescendo on the kind of Millie Dowler story that The Guardian splashed on, and everyone just seemed to think, oh, this has gone far too far now. But very quickly, The Guardian story did seem to appear not as strong as it was. Do you think that we still were dealing with the kind of emotional repercussions of that then?
Yeah, and remember Ed Miliband weighed in at that point, and he went to war with Rupert Murdoch over that story. The News of the World got closed down. It then emerged that the News of the World didn't deliberately delete that voicemail from Millie Dowler's phone, but the effect had already happened. And from that moment on, News International was just looking to preserve its business by giving up lots of information. And the reason why a lot of these journalists were arrested ultimately was because News International threw them to the wolves, in effect. They gave up private and personal emails about the stories that a company might not normally wish to hand over to the police. They volunteered that information, and because of that, the police set up this inquiry and probably felt duty-bound to investigate.
So why do you think that public condemnation tends to be now criticising the DPP and not, for example, News International or News UK, as it's now known, for frankly betraying its own employees?
It feels like they're getting it from all sides, the DPP, at the moment. It's not just these cases. There's the Greville Janna issue that's ongoing at the moment, and lots of other trials that have collapsed or people been found not guilty. And so there seems to be a lack of confidence in the DPP and the level of proof that is being required before they take some of these cases forward. And have they really considered whether a jury is going to have the information to get a prosecution? And there's a lot of very bitter journalists at the moment who have had their lives put on hold for 2 or 3 years, having been arrested, having not been able to earn a living for that time, for what they see as a purely malicious prosecution by the DPP in order to maybe curry favour with certain politicians to show the public that they're being tough on all this, but actually not acting in the public interest.
I mean, Lara, the DPP and the CPS seem to have got it right with Operation Yew Tree. They've prosecuted a lot of celebrities for sexual offences and many of them have been convicted, so they get the praise. Do you think that they've just done the same here, but because there's been a large amount of acquittals, they're now saying that they've overstepped the mark and they made a huge mistake? In a sense, they can't win, can they?
I think also this is a very kind of odd justice indeed. I mean, we're talking about here, you were talking about a kind of technicality. This is the use of a 13th century law to pursue journalists through the courts, which I think is kind of worth pointing out. And there's plenty of kind of ridiculous, outdated laws that exist in the UK. You know, if you stick a stamp upside down on an envelope, you're committing an act of treason. And those kinds of cases don't come to court. And this one just seemed a little bit exaggerated. And, you know, Oliver Blunt QC coming out defending The Sun, saying that this was a witch hunt. The fact that so many acquittals have taken place, the fact that, you know, people, as we were saying before, people's lives have been put on hold. People have been in this terrifying limbo for so long. It seems that when you kind of weigh out the amount of time, the £20 million that this operation has cost, it just doesn't seem like all this time and effort was kind of worthwhile, considering what we're now seeing the outcomes for.
When you talk to a lot of journalists covering your job, as it were, do you feel that that there's a chilling effect on Fleet Street? Do you think that this is something that the industry can just pick itself up from and move on? Or do you think it's going to have a lasting implication in terms of fear that reporters will feel?
I think it would were more reporters actually prosecuted. I think now we've seen so many acquittals, I think a lot of people can kind of breathe a sigh of relief. And some of those investigative stories that perhaps people were shy of undertaking, perhaps they'll be more inclined to move in that direction. Now, you know, it still is against the law to pay a public official. There's no mistaking that. But I think now journalists will feel like there's at least a weight off of their shoulders.
And the police have had, you know, much less willingness now to assist journalists when journalists are making serious inquiries about criminal offences and stories that they're pursuing, because of the chilling effect has really been that relationship between journalists and police sources. And now the police sources are really unwilling to give any information to journalists because they're afraid of what will happen if they're caught having spoken to a journalist, even though they haven't been paid for it.
Do you think Elverdon, Adam, was in some ways the police overcompensating for the kind of cosiness that they had with the media in the past? You'd hear of, you know, the chief of the Met Police going horse riding with Rebecca Wade and the Prime Minister and all this. It did seem a bit cosy, all this Chipping Norton set.
Yeah, of course, that was at the very top level between the senior officers, and, you know, they were very concerned about their public image and getting good coverage in The Sun, and the News of the World was very important to those senior police figures. Further down the chain, there's just ordinary coppers who've come across something that they think the public might want to know, and, you know, they've quite fancied a bit of money for it, but, you know, really that money shouldn't have been paid in a lot of those circumstances. Newspapers these days are much more cautious about how they go about conducting these investigations, the standard of proof. They've got to be able to prove how they got the evidence together. So there has been an effect, maybe a positive effect on newspapers. You know, there's less willingness to just throw caution to the wind and pay people for stories.
I was just about to say, it's kind of good that you now keep a paper chain. You know, it's right that everything you do as a reporter should be documented, so that if a case does come to, you know, does go as far as coming to a court, or even if it just comes as far as you being disciplined internally, you've got that to come back to and to defend yourself with, which, you know, going through all these News of the World files, as Operation Elvedon did, you know, it was extremely tricky to try and put the pieces together. And I think now journalists kind of realise, you know, you've got to have a lot more evidence to stack up in order to write these kinds of stories about public officials, about people that work in the NHS and so on. And unfortunately, maybe fortunately, whichever way you see it, money can't change hands anymore, so you've got to dig a bit deeper.
Well, Lara, for every so-called worthy story that a Sun journalist, or indeed anyone from any other paper, paid a public official to get, there were also the kind of tittle-tattle stories, and there was the kind of fishing expedition-type things where the Sun were buying copies of X Directory, you know, the Royal Phone Book, that there was no public interest in knowing the Queen's personal mobile number. I mean, surely that can't be justified.
No, certainly not. That's the whole, you know, is it in the public interest, or is it interesting to the public argument? And that's the question you have to ask yourself every time you're trying to write one of those stories. You know, is this something that's going to do a utilitarian good for the public, or is it just something that's interesting and we'll shift a couple more papers, so, and it's got to be the first.
Do you take Adam's point then, that whilst it's been unfortunate, that there's actually some good might have come out of this in the long run?
Yeah, as I was saying, I think certainly. I think, you know, it's good that every now and then we are accountable for what we do as journalists, and we're not audited in the way other industries sometimes are. And this is a weird way of going about an audit, and you know, in a way that a law firm or an accountancy wouldn't see it happen. And certainly I don't think these journalists should have had to pay the price that they did. But I think we've all had a chance as an industry to kind of look in and see what our issues were, and we've kind of come out for the better.
Adam, do you think there's an issue here that, I mean, I'm not defending News UK by any means, but they're coming under pressure not only to protect their sources and their staff, but they seem to be letting down both of them. I mean, what springs to mind is when Isabel Oakeshott of the Sunday Times was compelled by the High Court to disclose all of the emails to do with Vicky Price. I mean, they were confidential discussions with a source, and yet suddenly News UK turning them over wholesale, that they're confidential discussions with a source. So they don't seem to be just letting down their own staff, it's also sources. I mean, that can't carry on, can it? No one will have any faith in journalism.
Unfortunately, it's never very pretty if you get to see the communications that go on between journalists and someone that they're trying to encourage them to get a story out of. And obviously, in that case, she was using to coax Vicky Price, win her trust and her confidence. And when it's out there in court, everyone goes, oh, what an awful manipulative journalist. But at the end of the day, there was a story that came out about misuse of trying to get off the points in that case. And the prosecution did result from that. So it's difficult when journalists have to show their homework, because often there are situations you wouldn't want the public to see about how you might approach a source in order to win their trust and trying to get a story out of them. So that was particularly unfortunate.
But do you think News UK should have cooperated with the police at all?
They certainly had to show willing, because there'd clearly been previous investigations that had just been dropped at the start, because News International, as it was then, had said, look, there's nothing to see here, go away, you know, thank you very much, goodbye, there's been no hacking, nothing to concern you here.
So one rogue reporter,
yes, exactly.
The legendary phrase went.
Yeah, so then they had to defend, you know, the very company's existence was at stake to a large extent, so you can see why they would want to give the police, probably even try and dazzle the police with so much information that they probably didn't know what to do with it and how to sift through it, because you'd have to have, as it turned out, there were about 80 officers on this investigation, Elverdon, a lot more than were actually involved in looking at MPs' expenses. Mm. And so a disproportionate amount of police time was then having to be used in order to look through all these emails that News International decided to give up to save themselves.
Lara, do you think that it's business as usual now, from now on then?
It's business as usual to an extent. So I think a chill has kind of rattled down the spine of the industry, and some of us and some of the companies involved have come out of it for the better. You know, we're checking our tracks a lot more. We're making sure that we're not doing bad things for no reason. On the other hand, I think it does make journalists consider perhaps who they work for a little bit more than they perhaps did before. They need to think about the kind of company that they keep. They need to think about how they go about kind of obtaining stories. I mean, you only have to look at outside our industry as well. The Sony picture hacks, for example, and the amounts of what looked like dreadful bullying emails, you know, personal comments about Angelina Jolie, the kind of things that people say to each other down the pub and never think will ever be repeated and come up against you again. You know, it just makes you kind of second, you know, have a second thought about what you do when it comes to obtaining stories and going about your business as a journalist, I think.
So next, The Telegraph and BuzzFeed have been criticised for giving advertisers a say in their editorial decisions. Former Telegraph columnist Peter O'Born alleged that his old employers suppressed stories about key advertisers such as HSBC, a claim The Telegraph refutes. BuzzFeed also got caught, this time for deleting critical stories on their advertisers Dove and Hasbro. Editor-in-chief Ben Smith later restored the stories, saying that he blew it, but denied that they'd been removed because of advertiser pressure. Lara, how can editors balance their editorial responsibilities with keeping advertisers happy?
So whenever I'm asked this question, I refer back. There's a brilliant story from the 1980s when Andrew Neil was the editor of the Sunday Times.
The golden years.
So if you'll allow me. So basically, he was the editor of the Sunday Times. Mohammed Al-Fayed called him up in the mid-80s to complain about a story that they'd written, which was criticising the way that he was renovating a house in Paris that was once occupied by the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, I believe. So Neil offered him space to put across his point of view, and Al-Fayed refused, and he demanded a retraction, an apology. Andrew Neil refused, and then Al-Fayed threatened him to withdraw all Harrods advertising from all of the Times newspapers. And Neil said, "You can't do that." And Mohammed Al-Fayed said, "Why?" And he said, because from this moment on, you're banned from advertising in the Sunday Times.
Wow.
Later, about 30 minutes later, Rupert Murdoch calls him up and saying, you know, you've just banned our biggest advertiser. I think they spent about £3 million at the time. And they kind of talk it through, and Andrew Neil explains the situation. And Murdoch says, F him if he thinks we can be built for £3 million, and he hangs up. And I just think that's a brilliant stance. And that's from the 1980s. And it doesn't matter that we're 30 years ahead now. I think that stance should still apply now. If you bend to advertisers, and if you put across the fact that to one advertiser or to many that you're a soft touch, they'll do it again and again and again.
So it's like a zero tolerance strategy. You're welcome to advertise in our newspaper, but you get zero influence for that at all. And if you don't like it, you can lump it.
Precisely. And if you're offered a space to refute some claims, you know, take that up by all means. And I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, during the period in which Peter Oborne alleged that the Telegraph suppressed stories about HSBC, HSBC pulled advertising from The Guardian as well. You know, I guess rightly, because, you know, if you're British Gas and you're advertising next to an oil disaster, you wouldn't necessarily want to have those connotations either, or, you know, a gas explosion or something. So, you know, it just makes perfect sense that you have to stand by your editorial values and not bend just to the next kind of 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, in Neil's case, 3 million.
But I mean, if you look at the pressures, I mean, you've got the editor of the paper, of course, who'll have the editorial decisions to make. But then you've got the managing editor, who is often in the office next door, and they're in effect running it as a business. They don't care about the editorial stance, and they've got to look at the numbers. They're employing 50 journalists, and they've got this money coming in from the newsstand and this from subscriptions, and we need to plug the gap by advertising. Why are your journalists, Mr. Editor, upsetting our major advertiser? Because that will mean we'll have to make some staff redundant. I mean, can you not see that there is a risk? Because newspapers are still a business at the end of the day.
Well, there's also a problem if your journalists are hell-bent about destroying a company. I think if you don't have a hard line, it becomes too murky, and it becomes too easy to, all right, we'll let that one slide this once and then we won't do it again. And I think what happens is, I mean, the BuzzFeed example, What makes it worse if you don't have this stance, or you don't have these guidelines from the very outset? Because what's worse than the cover-up? Well, what's worse is the cover-up, and what's even worse for you is the cover-up being discovered. You know, this went undiscovered for quite a few months before a couple of publications found out that these articles had been deleted.
Mm.
So I think you've got to set out from the outset with your journalists, with the people on your commercial team, and also with your advertisers, this is where we stand. And if you want to discuss how we can work with you better, and maybe how we can apply these rules to our relationship, you know, brilliant, let's have an open conversation about it. But these discussions need to happen from the outset, and they can't just be changed for this story or that story.
Do you think readers, though, kind of understand? You know, they do it. I mean, I read the Evening Standard, but when I see a double-page extreme close-up picture of Evgeny Lebedev, I understand that that's not there for editorial reasons. It's because he owns the paper, and you kind of just move on. You accept it. The standard of their journalism still is incredibly strong. Do you think readers kind of get it, or do you think that there's some kind of higher moral responsibility here?
So it only takes one poor decision for your readers to lose trust, and it takes a lifetime. It takes years to build that trust back up again. And so I don't think you can just, you know, give a two-page spread of glowing editorial to one of your biggest advertisers for the sake of it and not expect that to get found out and not expect to lose a couple of readers along the way and have media columnists write about it. You're messing with an incredibly powerful tool here, and readers aren't stupid, and they will pull you up on it. And your competitors certainly will.
Adam, Lara's stance could be described as tough, robust, uncompromising. Is she right?
It's kind of the only stance that can work in order to maintain credibility of a newspaper. And advertisers do want newspapers to have that credibility, because there's no point. And once the newspaper starts losing that, then the advertisers will have no real power. It won't be a great vehicle for them anyway. So that is the right stance. But we now have a situation where there are whole departments within news organisations that are there to create advertorial opportunities. Often they're online opportunities, often they sit in the paper, often there's us in the Telegraph's case, they reviewed the last Judi Dench film set in India, the hotel film, and then they had a winter holiday to go alongside in India, visit the set of this film. And the film got quite a good review. In fact, maybe it got more stars than it ought to have done, given what the person had actually written, the reviewer. And so you wonder, at what point does it creep over when an editorial partnership with an advertiser suddenly becomes something that changes the nature of the editorial? And now we have native advertising, which is lots of people within newspapers. Some are journalists and some has just come from pure advertisers' copy, churning out paid for articles on websites and in the print sections of newspapers, where they usually are very clearly identified as advertorial. But the pressures are now such, and with the decline of print, and there's no doubt, obviously, that if newspapers are to survive, they need to actually have a closer relationship with advertisers. What you need is a really strong editor. I think in the Telegraph's case, they've had so many different changes in their structure that there wasn't really an editor in place with the power and authority to stand up maybe to the managing editor and say, what's going on here? The readers know if we're not reporting the HSBC scandal. It's the biggest story of the week everywhere else, and we're not reporting it. That's kind of going to be noticeable and damaging their credibility.
Well, very famously, of course, the Telegraph hasn't actually had an editor for the last couple of years. Jason Segan, God rest his soul, now departed, was editor-in-chief and chief content officer, wasn't he? But he didn't actually edit the paper. Those responsibilities were taken from him. So do you think being an editor is an unenviable job then, that you're going to get it in the neck from all sides, the owner, the business managers of the paper, as well as the journalists? You can't win, really, can you?
You can if you're strong. I suppose, I mean, Andrew Neil was a great editor, but maybe he was an editor at a time when the power of print was much greater. The sales were much greater. He knew they were going to sell 2 million copies every day. He could hold the whip hand over the advertisers. Now the advertisers are going to hold the whip hand over news organisations unless they're really, really tough about where those limits are. But it's worse in the online world with your BuzzFeeds, because they are really in the content business. They're not in the news business. They're in the business of shoveling out as much stuff as possible to get views and to get money and to get advertising. So what rules they have are likely to be less secure and firm than the ones that newspapers have built up over 100 years of tradition.
But do you think Lara's point is right, that the ultimate safety net is the trust of their readers and their viewers? Because once they think, I actually can't believe or trust in this, you know, in the editorial values of this newspaper or website, and they simply stop reading it, then the whole business model is knackered, isn't it?
It should do. But in the web world now, where that you have digital native readers, they may not be as familiar with that divide. If they're reading a website that it's churning out copy to produce link bait, they may not be as aware that there ought to be a distinction between advertising and editorial. And therefore, there may be a generation growing up now for whom that distinction, that the church and state distinction that journalists who've grown up through newspapers and, you know, have always seen as being absolutely sacrosanct, that might be eroded through organisations like BuzzFeed. And that's going to filter back, unfortunately, into news organisations, that kind of approach to it. Because if someone else is getting the ad money, you're going to want to get it as well.
So when you say, as you did earlier, about editorial sides of media operations working more closely with advertisers, how might that work? Because at the end of the day, if there is a winner holiday, brilliant. But you also have to trust in the star rating of the film review. And if you don't, then that is an issue, isn't it? So how can you work more closely with them while still maintaining that independent editorial stance?
There has to be clear information through to all the journalists about what they're doing and what they're writing and why. And just a clear, whether it's the editor or somebody there, who is saying, well, that's great, that's going to go in that section, or that's going to be a pullout, that's not going to run on these pages, because that will confuse things if people see these two things together. And it must be clearly labelled advertorial if it's an advertising-led initiative. So it's quite fair for newspapers, and there's so many sections in lifestyle sections in newspapers, there's plenty of space where there can be material that may have been part of an advertising profile. But I think we've even seen in The Guardian, when they had an Apple promotion, that they removed content that was critical of Apple because they were fearful of alienating one of their potential biggest advertisers. So it is creeping in across all different groups, left and right kind of centred groups.
Lara, how do you handle it on your website then, in terms of how do you differentiate between sponsored content, editorial, advertising, etc., etc.?
So I think, kind of back to one of the previous points, I think at a time of disintermediation online and...
Oh, that's a good word. Disintermediation.
I can only just about say
I'm glad
it.
You said it.
So, you know, editorial integrity is your news site's biggest asset. Anybody can take your story within 2 seconds of you putting it online
and disintermediate
it and have a headline up there and take your traffic away from you. So what really counts...
We won't mention the Mail Online at this point. that would be incredibly unfair to them, of course.
Oh, I think that would be. And I think there's an incredible amount of trust in the Mail Online brand.
No,
actually.
I meant in terms of the fact that they often take all everyone else's stories. And although they do credit it at the top, it's largely the people's copy. But sorry, I apologise. Carry on.
So the thing with native advertising is it's not new. We've had advertorial in newspapers for years and years. But I think where we're coming up to these kind of barriers and these issues at the moment is because native advertising is actually kind of new online. So what's happened is for years and years, brands have spent most of their money on TV, traditional advertising, newspapers and so on. Then they slowly started experimenting with their online spend, but it was still kind of search and banner ads. And it's only very recently that brands have put a bigger proportion towards their online advertising, doing, you know, big, almost TV-like campaigns with Facebook. They'll do a 30-second ad, which is very much like TV, on YouTube. And they enter into these branded content partnerships with newspapers. There was a six-figure one with Unilever and The Guardian, which was signed last year. So that was a commitment to do a certain amount of sustainability content, for example. So all of this is very new. And the problem when it's very new is that everybody makes mistakes when things are new because you haven't really got anything to kind of, you haven't got a reference point. And the other issue is that you don't know really what works and what doesn't because you've got nothing to compare it to either. So I think all the time we're seeing these kind of weird crossovers between what is editorial, what is advertorial. None of this is actually for the benefit of the reader at the moment. All the time we're trying to confuse readers and mask content up as something that it isn't. Eventually we'll work out that readers will get annoyed. I get really annoyed when I read something and it wasn't written by a journalist, it was written by a company. I think, what a waste of time, I've been duped. And I think,
or at least you could have been told at the outset, at the top of the article, that it was, and then you could have decided yourself whether to read it. And also, even if you'd chosen to read it, you would at least know at that point that it was advertorial.
Exactly. And I accept that there's a kind of value exchange. And if, you know, if people didn't advertise on Business Insider, I wouldn't get paid. That's our model. So I just think it will take a while for us to work out what works with native advertising and what doesn't. The other thing with native advertising also is that it's not a very easy to measure medium. It's not direct response. It's kind of, it's brand advertising. And just like TV advertising, when it comes to attribution, TV advertising it doesn't work straight away. You don't watch a Coca-Cola ad. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. You don't watch a Coca-Cola ad and think, I must buy one now and I'm going to leave my house and go to the shop. But it builds kind of affinity and recall and so on. And that's kind of what native advertising is doing. So a lot of the things you see at the moment are kind of think pieces from, I don't know, you have HP doing a piece about innovation or something. So it takes a longer time. People don't know how to measure it. And so I think, long story short, I think we're having a lot of hiccups at this stage. And I think it's only going to get better once advertisers actually realise what's best for their consumers. And we're not quite there yet. We're still experimenting. We're still making mistakes. Still putting some rubbish stuff out there that nobody reads as well.
Adam, just final point on this. You mentioned The Guardian and their relationship with Apple. In a sense, I don't think there's an actual impropriety issue here. I wonder if it's actually more worrying than that, because for me, I don't think there's been any kind of irregularities in terms of their relationship, but it's clear that The Guardian corporately are in love with Apple products. You know, when the iPhone 6 came out, Stephen Fry wrote the review and he said, this is the greatest thing in life. I mean, surely it's not even a financial thing. You just think, well, they've just lost all perspective, haven't they? Sometimes maybe that's an issue with trust with their readers.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to talking about companies' tax affairs, if Apple's tax affairs came under the same scrutiny as Google, you'd hope that you could rely on The Guardian to give it the same critical scrutiny as they would with any other company when they go hell for leather on HSBC and other areas. So yes, there's a natural affinity, and there may be, yes, there's a danger of just sleepwalking into a situation where, because you basically think a company's great and cool and you love all their products, that you don't actually look into it as critically as you would do to some others that are traditional bogey figures for, you know, paper like The Guardian, like McDonald's or some of those big corporations. Of course, I should also say that Evgeny Lebedev is a fantastic journalist and all his articles in The Standard are entirely justified on their merits. And
you're using an iPhone, I see.
Yes,
as am I. I declare an interest. So finally, as the general election approaches, newspapers have doubled efforts to persuade readers to vote for their preferred party, of course. Rupert Murdoch has told staff at his papers that they're not doing enough to stop a Labour government. And at the same time, The Express, unsurprisingly, splashed on its owner Richard Desmond's £1.3 million donation to UKIP. Adam, newspaper owners have always made their papers do their political bidding. What's different this time? And do you think newspapers still have the same influence they always had anyway?
Well, there's not a lot different this time because, in effect, we're reverting back to the situation I think we had in sort of the early 90s where Neil Kinnock was vilified and made to look a fool because most of the right-leaning newspapers were desperate to keep the Conservatives in government. They've now pinpointed Ed Miliband as being a particular threat to the Conservatives, partly because of his media policy where he is going to, what he sees as, reduce the amount of dominance that certain groups have in the media market. So for News International and Rupert Murdoch, and particularly because Ed Miliband went for them over phone hacking, they've decided, right, we need to take out Labour. We need to get the Conservatives into government. So in this case, they've gone particularly virulently for Labour in the last few months. And as The Independent discovered, this has a lot to do with a visit that Rupert Murdoch made to his executives at The Sun in February, when he said to them, look, the whole future of our company is at stake here. We need to get a much sharper pro-Conservative position in the newspaper and really hammer Ed Miliband. And for Sun readers, as The Sun would say, well, they kind of expect that. They're probably not all of them that sympathetic towards Ed Miliband's type of politics. We'll see how much influence it is going to have in this election. It's a very unpredictable election, and certainly there's no evidence to say that a newspaper is going to win it for a particular party. What does happen is it tends to reinforce perceptions of people. So the idea that Ed Miliband is weird, that he's not up to the job, those kind of things the newspapers are very keen to pursue. It seems to, at the moment anyway, that that perception isn't really cutting through as they hoped it would do during the campaign. And there might be other reasons that Labour is unpopular, but Ed Miliband is kind of not quite the disaster that people might have thought he would be.
Yeah, I should declare an interest. I am a member of the Labour Party, although not an activist, and one of my team is Ed's former speechwriter. But do you think there's an issue here with the media in terms of the Miliband team may or may not feel that the media are out to get them unfairly? Or do you think that they're just accurately portraying the fact that he's not a good media performer?
Well, he's actually improved a lot of his media performances. He's really worked on this. You could look at the Mirror and say it's staunchly pro-Labour every day. They give David Cameron very similar treatment that the right-wing papers give to Ed Miliband. So I think he's big enough to understand that you can't complain about the newspaper coverage. That just makes things 10 times worse if you complain about the media. So he's just having to try and go round the media to some extent. So a lot of what Labour does will be trying to use online mechanisms, using Twitter and using Facebook, using videos on YouTube to try and get through to people and try and get around the fact that the newspapers are not really going to give them a fair shake when it comes to assessing Labour's policies.
Do you think in that sense that Ed has made a rod for his own back then, that not only is he not necessarily a really good media performer, but like you say, because of the policy positions that he's taken on some of the media regulatory framework, particularly in regard to News UK, that he's not read how to win friends and influence people when it comes to media magnates?
Yeah, he kind of stumbled into the... You know, obviously, News International was an organisation he would love to have got the endorsements from. He was going to the parties and trying to glad hand with Rupert Murdoch.
Tony Blair famously, of course, did everything he could to curry favour with the Murdoch empire.
And had the Sun's endorsements up, and Labour had the Sun's support up until just before the last election, where they did a reverse on Gordon Brown and pulled the rug under him. So Ed Miliband decided to go to war with Rupert Murdoch. He's made that a key element of his personality and showing the strength of this character now. But he's actually, the policies he's advocating, introducing the Leveson in its full effect, backed by statute, breaking up what he sees as all-powerful media corporations through some kind of perhaps 33 or 34% of the market, a figure that's very hard to identify with online added into print, who actually has the most eyeballs in terms of the newspaper groups, because that would actually be Associated and Daily Mail Group, because of their online influence, would actually meet that figure before News International would. So some very tough policies, interventionist policies in the media market. So I think newspapers would probably feel well within their rights to say, well, this is a bit of a threat to their freedom and independence.
I mean, quite apart from the political tactics of whether he's making friends or not, what do you think he's right on the policy itself?
I think that, as I say, on the media plurality issue, how really are you going to analyse what is a dangerous amount of dominance for one newspaper group? If you say it's this level, what they're going to try and do is pick a figure that News International is just or below and say, right, that's the figure, it's going to hit News International. It seems the policy seems to be designed to hit News International and News UK products. That can't be a good policy. If they want it to hit the other newspaper groups, if they want it to hit the Daily Mail group as well, then okay. But it does look a little bit like they're targeting newspaper groups that have political affiliations that are hostile to Labour. So that can't really be a basis of good policy.
Do you not think, though, that it ignores the kind of globalised environment that the media's in now? Because, we have British newspapers published in Britain for British readers, but most of my websites that I read every day are hosted in different territories and different jurisdictions and subjected to different legal and regulatory frameworks, even if Leveson was implemented. it would only affect maybe 5% of what I actually read online.
Yeah, Leveson itself didn't quite take into account the digital revolution that was overtaking newspapers and the fact that print isn't so dominant in people's lives. So, yeah, it feels like a policy that appeals to Labour's activist base, but actually it's going to be very hard to implement. But if there is a LibLab coalition or with the SNP, then they all share this similar idea that there has to be controls on the press. And they do feel that the public has changed its position since the phone hacking scandal. And they think there's an appetite out there for tougher controls of the press. I'm not quite sure that that's going to be borne out.
Lara, on May the 7th, on Election Day, will Business Insider kind of splash and have a full screen with a big red rosette saying vote Labour?
We certainly won't. We'll certainly be covering it. We only launched in the UK a few months ago, but we're going to be covering it in earnest on the night.
It's a fantastic website. We all have to agree that. I do read it every day.
Me too. I think there is a danger sometimes within Fleet Street and indeed within the regulatory environment as well of kind of over-egging the clout of Fleet Street. You know, you were talking then about kind of Mail Online and the incredible reach that has. You know, it broke the 100 million barrier globally worldwide quite some time ago, kind of 3 years ago, I think, and God knows where it is now. But arguably, you know, while it has this incredible readership, those people are coming to certain stories. They're arguably not coming to The Leader, the stories about Ed Miliband. And the same with The Sun's readers online, the same with The Telegraph and so on. That's an important point to make as well, is that, you know, national newspapers have lost an incredible amount of their readership. Mm. Young people tend to go online first for their news, and they tend to, a lot of the time, they tend to come into news from a site like Facebook or from WhatsApp or Twitter, and they're coming into certain stories and they'll dip in and dip out. So I think as far as kind of clout is concerned, as to whether, you know, the newspapers, whether the proprietors will win the election, actually, I think it's swinging the balance at least more towards the online media, towards Facebook, towards those the activist friend that you have on your Facebook feed that talks a lot about Russell Brand, you know, even the TV debates and so on. And I think that's just an important point to make as well, that disintermediation point I was talking about earlier.
We're going to change the name of this podcast to the Disintermediation Podcast.
That power is perhaps diluting as we move online, and I think the papers that will win it will actually be those that kind of accept that and do clever things to be able to pull those readers in and get them interested in politics. So I've seen quite a few papers doing interesting kind of surveys on who will you vote for, and you pick between four policies and you end up with the SNP or whoever it might be. And I think perhaps that's the way that newspapers should be going about this. And I think that's something that perhaps their owners don't realise. I think their owners are speaking to their editors and they're looking at page 1, 2, and 3 and saying, brilliant, we've got another, we're doing a Neil Kinnock again kind of thing. And actually, the majority of their readers probably won't take that into account.
Do you think there's something to be said, though, in terms of the value of newspapers still, that curated experience is important? So, for example, you know, I have my Facebook feed and the algorithm decides what newspaper stories in isolation it's going to show me. As you said, guided by what my friends liked yesterday. And given that I'm a bit of a lefty or whatever and I have a certain clique of friends, inevitably there's going to be a bit of self-censorship there because they're not going to like a right-wing oriented story. And isn't there something to be said for having a curated experience that, you know, a newspaper does have a linear thing. You look at the splash, they've clearly decided that's the most interesting story of the day, and then you literally browse the paper. Do you think there's any value to that still, or do you think that's dead?
No, there's certainly a value to that, and I think you know, we should all still aspire to be that kind of fourth estate. But I think most readers don't look at it like that. They, you know, I think, and especially a lot of young readers, they will dip in out and out, and I think they don't necessarily, they're not as loyal to news brands, perhaps, as they once were. They're still news junkies. People still love news. But more and more, they're a little bit more promiscuous about where they get that news from. That said, there's something important in news brands, like we were talking about before. There is a trust element. And if you go to a site just because you saw an interesting headline and you're bombarded with advertisements and there's spelling mistakes and there's kind of weird links everywhere, you're probably not going to come back, and you will eventually fall to your kind of repertoire of, say, 5 or 6 outlets. So we should still try to curate, because, you know, readers will still browse. You know, there is still incredible value in the homepage. But I think we've also got to realise that our brand also stands for every single article they look at. So you've got to make sure that every single article is something that's going to try and draw them in. not just the one splash story that you have that day that's going to dominate your website and your front page.
Final question, Adam. Do you think there'll be further consolidation in terms of the sheer number of titles that there are? Because as Lara points out, readers are more promiscuous, loyalty to individual brands, people dip in and out of a page here and a page there. You know, can we carry on with the same number of newspapers we have now, say 10 years from now?
I suppose it will depends how you define a newspaper. They may not all be there in the same print form, but I think those big titles that carry a lot of weight, some may continue in a digital form. Some will continue as a free sheet, like the Evening Standard has made that transition. It's a different form of the way that the newspaper is bought, is consumed, but has given it a new lease of life. So there could be consolidation, but essentially, given that you can reduce the cost of distribution in print and actually form a whole different business, there's actually as many potential futures for some of those newspapers as there are difficulties in maintaining. I think the problem might be the Express paper, because as we've seen with the Desmond donation to UKIP, there's very little credibility those newspapers have got left. And they used to be very powerful and influential and credible newspapers with a distinct point of view, maybe conservative, but still very, very, quality journalism.
And now some might say it's a poor imitation of the Mail.
And you wonder how many of their readers would miss, you know, those papers if they didn't exist. Would they go to other newspapers? Would they go to the Sun? Or would they drift out of newspaper reading altogether? You know, the problem is when papers disappear in all forms is that those readers don't tend to go to other newspapers. They tend to just be lost to the market.
What interests me about the Express is every day it seems to have some kind of giveaway of a chocolate bar or something else. I mean, it literally, you almost want to buy the chocolate bar. You think, I'll buy the paper and get the chocolate bar for free. It's the ultimate in bribery. Well, listen, guys, it's been great, but unfortunately we've run out of metaphorical tape, as I always say, so we'll have to bring proceedings to a close. Lara, how do people follow you on Twitter? And, what is the website address? How do people read your writing?
So if you want to find me, I'm at Lara Chiara. I won't explain very long story
this
behind
that
name.
This is the best bit of the whole podcast, where people have to explain their woeful choice of Twitter name.
Well, maybe if you follow me on Twitter, you'll find out. So Lara Chiara, and it's businessinsider.com.
Thank you, Lara. Adam?
I'm at Adam Sherwin 10, which I saddled myself with. Couldn't believe there was another Adam Sherwin already out there, but there you go.
Another nine, probably.
yes, they probably are somewhere. And I'll be in The Independent on Sunday.
For those that want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Paul W.R. Blanchard, and you can go to the website mediafocus.org.uk and leave your email, where you will then receive a notification once a fortnight when the podcast is released. But that's it. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'm Paul Blanchard. The associate producer was Jordan Greenway. Catch you next time.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things.